Out away, free as a bird. He brandished the slapstick a bit. And none of your petty philosophy, or I'll make you sorry you ever took a shining to that little game.
I nodded. I cleared my mind with one of the tricks I'd already learned, and bore down on believing. I started to sweat. After what may have been 10 minutes, I nodded again. He let go of the rock. It fell. I began to get a headache. He picked the rock back up.
Do you believe that it floated?
No.
I sulked, rubbing my temples.
Good. It didn't. Never fool yourself into perceiving things that don't exist. It's a fine line to walk, but sympathy is not an art for the weak-willed.
He held out the rock again.
Do you believe it will float?
It didn't.
It doesn't matter. Try again.
He shook the stone.
Allah is the cornerstone of sympathy. If you're going to impose your will on the world, you must have control over what you believe.
I tried, and I tried. It was the most difficult thing I had ever done. It took me almost all afternoon. Finally, Ben was able to drop the rock, and I retained my firm belief that it wouldn't fall despite evidence to the contrary. I heard the thump of the rock, and I looked at Ben. I've got it, I said calmly, feeling more than a little smug. He looked at me out of the corner of his eye as if he didn't quite believe me, but didn't want to admit it. He picked at the rock absently with one fingernail, then shrugged and held it up again.
I want you to believe the rock will fall, and that the rock will not fall when I let go of it.
He grinned. I went to bed late that night. I had a nosebleed and a smile of satisfaction. I held the two separate beliefs loosely in my mind and let their singing discord lull me into senselessness. Being able to think about two disparate things at once, aside from being wonderfully efficient, was roughly akin to being able to sing harmony with yourself. It turned into a favorite game of mine. After 2 days of practicing, I was able to sing a trio. Soon I was doing the mental equivalent of palming cards and juggling knives. There were many other lessons, though none were quite so pivotal as the Allah. Ben taught me Heart of Stone, a mental exercise that lets you set aside your emotions and prejudices and lets you think clearly about whatever you wish. Ben said a man who truly mastered Heart of Stone could go to his sister's funeral without ever shedding a tear. He also taught me a game called Seek the Stone. The point of the game was to have one part of your mind hide an imaginary stone in an imaginary room. Then you had another, separate part of your mind try to find it. Practically, it teaches valuable mental control. If you can really play Seek the Stone, then you are developing an iron-hard Allah of the sort you need for sympathy. However, while being able to think about two things at the same time is terribly convenient, the training it takes to get there is frustrating at best, and at other times rather disturbing. I remember one time I looked for the stone for almost an hour before I consented to ask the other half of me where I'd hidden it. Only to find I hadn't hidden the stone at all. I had merely been waiting to see how long I would look before giving up. Have you ever been annoyed and amused with yourself at the same time? It's an interesting feeling, to say the very least. Another time I asked for hints and ended up jeering at myself. It's no wonder that many arcanists you meet are a little eccentric, if not downright cracked. As Ben had said, sympathy is not for the weak of mind. Chapter 11. The Binding of Iron. I sat in the back of Abenthi's wagon. It was a wonderful place for me, home to 100 bottles and bundles saturated with 1,000 smells. To my young mind, it was usually more fun than a tinker's cart, but not today. It had rained heavily the night before, and the road was a thick morass of mud. Since the troop was not on any particular schedule, we had decided to wait for a day or two to give the roads time to dry. It was a fairly common occurrence, and it happened to fall at the perfect time for Ben to further my education. So I sat at the wooden work table in the back of Ben's wagon, and chafed at wasting the day, listening to him lecture me about things I already understood. My thoughts must have been apparent, because Abenthy sighed and sat down beside me.
Not quite what you expected, eh?
I relaxed a bit, knowing his tone meant a temporary reprieve from the lecture. He gathered up a handful of the iron drabs that were sitting on the table and clinked them together thoughtfully in his hand. He looked at me.
Did you learn to juggle all at once? 5 balls at a time, knives too?
I flushed a bit at the memory. Trip hadn't even let me try 3 balls at first. He'd made me juggle 2. I'd even dropped them a couple of times. I told Ben so.
Right, Ben said. Master this trick and you get to learn another.
I expected him to stand up and start back into the lesson, but he didn't. Instead, he held out the handful of iron drabs.
What do you know about these?
He clattered them together in his hand.
In what respect? I asked. Physically, chemically, historically?
Historically, he grinned. Astound me with your grasp of historical minutiae, Elir.
I had asked him what Elir meant once. He claimed it meant wise one, but I had my doubts from the way his mouth had quirked when he said it.
A long time ago, the people who—
How long ago?
I frowned at him in mock severity.
Roughly 2,000 years ago. The nomadic folk who roamed the foothills around the Shalda Mountains were brought together under one chieftain.
What was his name?
Heldred. His sons were Heldim and Heldar. Would you like his entire lineage, or should I get to the point?
I glowered at him.
Sorry, sir.
Ben sat up straight in his seat and assumed such an aspect of rapt attention that we both broke into grins. I started again.
Heldred eventually controlled the foothills around the Shalda. This meant that he controlled the mountains themselves. They started to plant crops. Their nomadic lifestyle was abandoned, and they slowly began to
get to the point? Abenthy
asked. He tossed the drabs onto the table in front of me. I ignored him as best I could.
They controlled the only plentiful and easily accessible source of metal for a great distance, and soon they were the most skilled workers of those metals as well. They exploited this advantage and gained a great deal of wealth and power. Until this point, barter was the most common method of trade. Some larger cities coined their own currency, but outside those cities the money was only worth the weight of the metal. Bars of metal were better for bartering, but full bars of metal were inconvenient to carry.
Ben gave me his best bored student face. The effect was only slightly inhibited by the fact that he had burned his eyebrows off again about 2 days ago.
You're not going to go into the merits of representational currency, are you?
I took a deep breath and resolved not to pester Ben so much when he was lecturing me.
The no longer nomads, called the Kaeldim by now, were the first to establish a standardized currency. By cutting one of these smaller bars into 5 pieces, you get 5 drabs.
I began to piece 2 rows of 5 drabs each together to illustrate my point. They resembled little ingots of metal.
10 drabs are the same as a copper jot. 10 jots,
good enough,
Ben broke in, startling me.
So these 2 drabs,
he held a pair out for my inspection,
could have come from the same bar, right?
Actually, they probably cast them individually.
I trailed off under a glare.
Sure.
So there's something still connecting them, right?
He gave me the look again. I didn't really agree, but knew better than to interrupt.
Right.
He set them both on the table.
So when you move one, the other should move, right?
I agreed for the sake of argument, then reached out to move one. But Ben stopped my hand, shaking his head.
You've got to remind them first. You've got to convince them, in fact.
He brought out a bowl and decanted a slow blob of pine pitch into it. He dipped one of the drabs into the pitch, and stuck the other one to it, spoke several words I didn't recognize, and slowly pulled the bits apart, strands of pitch stretching between them. He set one on the table, keeping the other in his hand. Then he muttered something else and relaxed. He raised his hand, and the drab on the table mimicked the motion. He danced his hand around, and the brown piece of iron bobbed in the air. He looked from me to the coin.
The law of sympathy is one of the most basic parts of magic. It states that the more similar two objects are, the greater the sympathetic link. The greater the link, the more easily they influence each other.
Your definition is circular.
He set down the coin. His lecturer's facade gave way to a grin as he tried with marginal success to wipe the pitch off his hands with a rag. He thought for a while.
Seems pretty useless, doesn't it?
I gave a hesitant nod. Trick questions were fairly common around lesson time.
Would you rather learn how to call the wind?
His eyes danced at me. He murmured a word and the canvas ceiling of the wagon rustled around us. I felt a grin capture my face. Wolfish.
Too bad, Elir.
His grin was wolfish too and savage.
You need to learn your letters before you can write. You need to learn the fingerings on the strings before you can play and sing.
He pulled out a piece of paper and jotted a couple of words on it.
The trick is in holding the Alar firm in your mind. You need to believe they are connected. You need to know they are.
He handed me the paper.
Here is the phonetic pronunciation. It's called the sympathetic binding of parallel motion. Practice.
He looked even more lupine than before, old and grizzled with no eyebrows. He left to wash his hands. I cleared my mind using Heart of Stone. Soon I was floating on a sea of dispassionate calm. I stuck the two bits of metal together with pine pitch. I fixed in my mind the Alar, the riding crop belief that the two drabs were connected. I said the words, pulled the coins apart, spoke the last word, and waited. No rush of power. No flash of hot or cold. No radiant beam of light struck me. I was rather disappointed. At least as disappointed as I could be in the Heart of Stone. I lifted the coin in my hand, and the coin on the table lifted itself in a similar fashion. It was magic. There was no doubt about that. But I felt rather underwhelmed. I had been expecting... I don't know what I'd been expecting. It wasn't this. The rest of that day was spent experimenting with the simple sympathetic binding Abenthy had taught me. I learned that almost anything could be bound together, an iron drab and a silver talent, a stone and a piece of fruit, two bricks, a clod of earth and one of the donkeys. It took me about 2 hours to figure out that the pine pitch wasn't necessary. When I asked him, Ben admitted that it was merely an aid for concentration. I think he was surprised that I figured it out without being told. Let me sum up sympathy very quickly, since you will probably never need to have anything other than a rough comprehension of how these things work. First, energy cannot be created or destroyed. When you are lifting one drab, and the other rises off the table, the one in your hand feels as heavy as if you're lifting both, because in fact, you are. That's in theory. In practice, it feels like you're lifting three drabs. No sympathetic link is perfect. The more dissimilar the items, the more energy is lost. Think of it as a leaky aqueduct leading to a water wheel. A good sympathetic link has very few leaks, and most of the energy is used. A bad link is full of holes. Very little of the effort you put into it goes towards what you want it to do. For instance, I tried linking a piece of chalk to a glass bottle of water. There was very little similarity between the two, so even though the bottle of water might have weighed 2 pounds, when I tried to lift the chalk, it felt like 60 pounds. The best link I found was a tree branch I had broken in half. After I understood this little piece of sympathy, Ben taught me others. A dozen sympathetic bindings. 100 little tricks for channeling power. Each of them was a different word in a vast vocabulary I was just beginning to speak. Quite often it was tedious, and I'm not telling you the half of it. Ben continued giving me a smattering of lessons in other areas, history, arithmetic, and chemistry. But I grabbed at whatever he could teach me about sympathy. He doled out his secrets sparingly, making me prove I'd mastered one before giving me another. But I seemed to have a knack for it above and beyond my natural penchant for absorbing knowledge, so there was never too long a wait. I don't mean to imply that the road was always smooth. The same curiosity that made me such an eager student also led me into trouble, with fair regularity. One evening, as I was building up my parents' cookfire, my mother caught me chanting a rhyme I had heard the day before. Not knowing that she was behind me, she overheard as I knocked one stick of firewood against another and absent-mindedly recited,
"Seven things has Lady Lackless, keeps them underneath her black dress. One a ring that's not for wearing, one a sharp word not for swearing. Right beside her husband's candle, there's a door without a handle. In a box, no lid or locks, Lackless keeps her husband's rocks. There's a secret she's been keeping, she's been dreaming and not sleeping, on a road that's not for travelling, Lackless likes her riddle ravelling."
I had heard a little girl chant it as she played hop-skip. I'd only heard it twice, but it had stuck in my head. It was memorable, as most child rhymes are. But my mother heard me and came over to stand by the fire.
"What were you just saying, sweet?"
Her tone wasn't angry, but I could tell she wasn't pleased either.
"Something I heard back in Fallows,"
I said evasively. Running off with town children was a largely forbidden activity. Distrust turns quickly to dislike, my father told new members of our troop, so stay together when you're in town and be polite. I laid some heavier sticks on the fire and let the flames lick them. My mother was silent for a while, and I was beginning to hope she would leave it alone when she said,
"It's not a nice thing to be singing. Have you stopped to think what it's about?"
I hadn't, actually. It seemed mostly nonsense rhyme. But when I ran it back through my head, I saw the rather obvious sexual innuendo.
"I do. I didn't think about it before."
Her expression grew a little gentler, and she reached down to smooth my hair.
"Always think about what you're singing, honey."
I seemed to be out of trouble, but I couldn't keep from asking,
"How is it any different than parts of For All His Waiting, like when Fane asks Lady Periel about her hat? I heard about it from so many men, I wish to see it for myself and try the fit. It's pretty obvious what he's really talking about."
I watched her mouth grow firm, not angry, but not pleased. Then something in her face changed.
"You tell me what the difference is," she said.
I hated bait questions. The difference was obvious. One would get me in trouble, the other wouldn't. I waited a while to make it clear I had given the matter proper consideration before I shook my head. My mother knelt lightly in front of the fire, warming her hands.
"The difference is... Go fetch me the tripod, would you?"
She gave me a gentle push, and I scampered off to get it from the back of our wagon as she continued.
"The difference is between saying something to a person and saying something about a person. The first might be rude, but the second is always gossip."
I brought the tripod back and helped her set it over the fire.
"Also, Lady Periel is just a character. Lady Lackless is a real person with feelings that can be hurt."
She looked up at me.
"I didn't know,"
I protested guiltily. I must have struck a sufficiently piteous figure, because she gathered me in for a hug and a kiss.
It's nothing to cry over, sweet one. Just remember to always think about what you're doing.
She ran her hand over my head and smiled like the sun.
I imagine you could make it up to both Lady Lackless and myself if you found some sweet nettle for the pot tonight.
Any excuse to escape judgment and play for a while in the tangle of trees by the roadside was good enough for me. I was gone almost before the words left her mouth. I should also make it clear that much of the time I spent with Ben was my free time. I was still responsible for my normal duties in the troop. I acted the part of the young page when needed. I helped paint scenery and sew costumes. I rubbed down the horses at night and rattled the sheet of tin backstage when we needed thunder on stage. But I didn't bemoan the loss of my free time. A child's endless energy and my own insatiable lust for knowledge made the following year one of the happiest times I can remember. Chapter 12. Puzzle Pieces Fitting. Towards the end of the summer, I accidentally overheard a conversation that shook me out of my state of blissful ignorance. When we are children, we seldom think of the future. This innocence leaves us free to enjoy ourselves as few adults can. The day we fret about the future is the day we leave our childhood behind. It was evening and the troop was camped by the side of the road. Abenthi had given me a new piece of sympathy to practice. The maxim of variable heat transferred to constant motion, or something pretentious like that. It was tricky, but it had fallen into place like a puzzle piece fitting. It had taken about 15 minutes, and from Abenthi's tone, I guessed he had expected it to take 3 or 4 hours at least. So I went looking for him. Partly to get my next lesson, and partly so that I could be just a little bit smug. I tracked him down to my parents' wagon. I heard the three of them long before I saw them. Their voices were just murmurs, the distant music that a conversation makes when it's too dim for words. But as I was coming close, I heard one word, clearly. Chandrian. I pulled up short when I heard that. Everyone in the troop knew my father was working on a song. He'd been teasing old stories and rhymes from townsfolk for over a year, wherever we stopped to play. For months it was stories about Lanre. Then he started gathering old fairy stories too, legends about bogies and shamblemen. Then he began to ask questions about the Chandrian. That was months ago. Over the last half year, he had asked more about the Chandrian and less about Lanre, Lyra, and the rest. Most songs my father set to writing were finished in a single season, while this one was stretching toward its second year. You should know this as well. My father never let word or whisper of a song be heard before it was ready to play. Only my mother was allowed into his confidence, as her hand was always in any song he made. The cleverness in the music was his. The best words were hers. When you wait a few span or month to hear a finished song, the anticipation adds savor. But after a year, excitement begins to sour. By now, a year and a half had passed, and folk were almost mad with curiosity. This occasionally led to hard words when someone was caught wandering a little too close to our wagon while my father and mother were working. So I moved closer to my parents' fire, stepping softly. Eavesdropping is a deplorable habit, but I have developed worse ones since.
"Much about them," I heard Ben say, "but I'm willing."
"I'm glad to talk with an educated man on the subject." My father's strong baritone was a contrast to Ben's tenor. "I'm weary of these superstitious country folk and the..."
Someone added wood to the fire, and I lost my father's words in the crackling that followed. Stepping as quickly as I dared, I moved into the long shadow of my parents' wagon.
"Like I'm chasing ghosts with this song, trying to piece together this story as a fool's game. I wish I'd never started it."
"Nonsense," my mother said.
This will be your best work, and you know it.
So you think there is an original story all the others stem from?
Ben asked.
An historical basis for Lanre?
All the signs point to it, my father said. It's like looking at a dozen grandchildren and seeing 10 of them have blue eyes. You know the grandmother had blue eyes, too. I've done this before. I'm good at it. I wrote below the walls the same way, but... I heard him sigh.
What's the problem, then?
The story's older, my mother explained. It's more like he's looking at great-great-grandchildren.
And they're scattered to the four corners, my father groused. And when I finally do find one, it's got 5 eyes, 2 greens, a blue, a brown, and a chartreuse. Then the next one has only 1 eye, and it changes color. How am I supposed to draw conclusions from that? Ben cleared his throat.
A disturbing analogy, he said. But you're welcome to pick my brain about the Chandrian. I've heard a lot of stories over the years.
The first thing I need to know is how many there actually are, my father said. Most stories say 7, but even that's conflicted. Some say 3, others 5. And in Felia's Fall there are a full 13 of them, 1 for each pontifet in Artur and an extra for the capital.
That I can answer, Ben said. 7. You can hold to that with some certainty. It's part of their name, actually. Shane means 7. Shane Dian means 7 of them. Chandrian.
I didn't know that, my father said. Shane. What language is that, Ilish?
Sounds like Tamer, my mother said.
You've got a good ear, Ben said to her. It's Tamic, actually, predates Tamer by about 1,000 years.
Well, that simplifies things, I heard my father say. I wish I'd asked you a month ago. I don't suppose you know why they do what they do. I could tell by my father's tone that he didn't really expect an answer.
Oh, that's the real mystery, isn't it?
Ben chuckled.
I think that's what makes them more frightening than the rest of the bogeymen you hear about in stories. A ghost wants revenge, a demon wants your soul, a shamble man is hungry and cold. It makes them less terrible. Things we understand we can try to control. But Chandrian come like lightning from a clear blue sky. Just destruction, no rhyme or reason to it.
My song will have both, my father said with grim determination. I think I've dug up their reason. After all this while, I've teased it together from bits and pieces of story. That's what's so galling about this, to have the harder part of this done and have all these small specifics giving me such trouble.
You think you know?
Ben said curiously.
What's your theory?
My father gave a low chuckle. Oh, no, Ben. You'll have to wait with the others. I've sweated too long over this song to give away the heart of it before it's finished. I could hear the disappointment in Ben's voice.
I'm sure this is all just an elaborate ruse to keep me traveling with you, he groused. I won't be able to leave until I've heard the blackened thing.
Then help us finish it, my mother said. The Chandrian signs are another key piece of information we can't nail down. Everyone agrees there are signs that warn of their presence, but nobody agrees on what they are.
Let me think, Ben said. Blue flame is obvious, of course, but I'd hesitate to attribute that to the Chandrian in particular. In some stories it's a sign of demons, in others it's fey creatures or magic of any sort.
It shows bad air in mines, too,
my mother pointed out.
Does it?
My father asked. She nodded.
When a lamp burns with a blue haze, you know there's fire damp in the air.
Good Lord, fire damp in a coal mine, my father said. Blow out your light and get lost in the black, or leave it burn and blow the whole place to flinders. That's more frightening than any demon.
I'll also admit to the fact that certain arcanists occasionally use prepared candles or torches to impress gullible townsfolk,
Ben said, clearing his throat self-consciously. My mother laughed.
Oh, remember who you're talking to, Ben. We'd never hold a little showmanship against a man. In fact, blue candles would be just the thing. the next time we played Aeonica, if you happened to find a couple tucked away somewhere, that is.
I'll see what I can do, Ben said, his voice amused. Other signs. One of them is supposed to have eyes like a goat, or no eyes, or black eyes. I've heard that one quite a bit. I've heard that plants die when the Chandrian are around. Wood rots, metal rusts, brick crumbles.
He paused.
Though I don't know if that's several signs or all one sign.
You begin to see the trouble I'm having, my father said morosely. And there's still the question as to if they all share the same signs or have a couple each.
I've told you, my mother said, exasperated. One sign for each of them. It makes the most sense.
My lady wife's favorite theory, my father said. But it doesn't fit. In some stories, the only sign is blue flame. In others, you have animals going crazy and no blue flame. In others, you have a man with black eyes and animals going mad and blue flame.
I've told you how to make sense of that, she said, her irritated tone indicating they'd had this particular discussion before. They don't always have to be together. They could go out in threes or fours. If one of them makes fires dim, then it'll look the same as if they all made the fires dim. That would account for the differences in the stories, different numbers and different signs, depending on how they're grouped together.
My father grumbled something.
That's a clever wife you got there, Al,
Ben spoke up, breaking the tension.
How much will you sell her for?
I need her for my work, unfortunately. But if you're interested in a short-term rental, I'm sure we could arrange a re- There was a fleshy thump, followed by a slightly pained chortle in my father's baritone. Any other signs that spring to mind?
They're supposed to be cold to the touch. Though how anyone could know that is beyond me. I've heard that fires don't burn around them. Though that directly contradicts the blue flame. It could...
The wind picked up, stirring the trees. The rustling leaves drowned out what Ben said. I took advantage of the noise to creep a few steps closer. Being yoked to shadow, whatever that means, I heard my father say as the wind died down. Ben grunted.
Oh, I couldn't say either. I couldn't say either. I heard a story where they were given away because their shadows pointed the wrong way. Towards the light, and there was another where one of them was referred to as Shadow-hamed. It was something the Shadow-hamed. Damned if I can remember the name, though.
Speaking of names, that's another point I'm having trouble with, my father said. There are a couple of dozen I've collected that I'd appreciate your opinion on. The most...
Actually are,
Ben interrupted.
I'd appreciate it if you didn't say them out loud. Names of people, that is. You can scratch them in the dirt if you'd like, or I could go fetch a slate, but I'd be more comfortable if you didn't actually say any of them. Better safe than sore, as they say.
There was a deep piece of silence. I stopped mid-sneak with one foot off the ground, afraid they'd heard me.
Now don't go looking at me like that, either of you,
Ben said testily.
We're just surprised, Ben,
came my mother's gentle voice.
You don't seem the superstitious type.
I'm not,
Ben said.
I'm careful. There's a difference.
Of course, my father said. I'd never...
Save it for the paying customers, Al,
Ben cut him off, irritation plain in his voice.
You're too good an actor to show it, but I know perfectly well when someone thinks him daft.
I just didn't expect it, Ben, my father said apologetically. You're educated, and I'm so tired of people touching iron and tipping their beer as soon as I mention the Chandrian. I'm just reconstructing a story, not meddling with dark arts.
Well, hear me out. I like both of you too well to let you think of me as an old fool, Ben said. Besides... I have something to talk with you about later, and I'll need you to take me seriously for that.
The wind continued to pick up, and I used the noise to cover my last few steps. I edged around the corner of my parents' wagon and peered through a veil of leaves. The three of them were sitting around the campfire. Ben was sitting on a stump, huddled in his frayed brown cloak. My parents were opposite him, my mother leaning against my father, a blanket draped loosely around them. Ben poured from a clay jug into a leather mug and handed it to my mother. His breath fogged as he spoke.
"How do they hear about demons off in Arthur?"
he asked. "Scared," my father tapped his temple. "All that religion makes their brains soft."
"How about off in Vintus?"
Ben asked.
"Fair number of them are Taelines. Do they feel the same way?"
My mother shook her head.
"They think it's a little silly. They like their demons metaphorical."
"What are they afraid of at night in Vintus, then?"
"The Fae,"
my mother said. My father spoke at the same time. "Draugr."
"You're both right, depending on which part of the country you're in,"
Ben said.
"And here in the Commonwealth, people laugh up their sleeves at both ideas."
He gestured at the surrounding trees.
"But here they're careful, come autumn time, for fear of drawing the attention of shamble men."
"That's the way of things," my father said. "Half of being a good trooper is knowing which way your audience leans."
"You still think I've gone cracked in the head?"
Ben said, amused.
"Listen, if tomorrow we pulled into Biren and someone told you there were shamble men in the woods, would you believe them?"
My father shook his head.
"What if two people told you?"
Another shake. Ben leaned forward on his stump.
"What if a dozen people told you with perfect earnestness that shamble men were out in the fields eating—"
"Of course I wouldn't believe them," my father said, irritated. "It's ridiculous."
"Of course it is,"
Ben agreed, raising a finger.
"But the real question is this. Would you go into the woods?"
My father sat very still and thoughtful for a moment. Ben nodded.
"You'd be a fool to ignore half the town's warning, even though you don't believe the same thing they do, if not shamble men. What are you afraid of?"
"Bears."
"Bandits."
"Good, sensible fears for a trooper to have,"
Ben said.
"Fears that townsfolk don't appreciate. Every place has its little superstitions, and everyone laughs at what the folk across the river think."
He gave them a serious look.
"But have either of you ever heard a humorous song or story about the Chandrian? I'll bet a penny you haven't."
My mother shook her head after a moment's thought. My father took a long drink before joining her.
"Now I'm not saying that the Chandrian are out there, striking like lightning from the clear blue sky. But folk everywhere are afraid of them. There's usually a reason for that."
Ben grinned and tipped his clay cup, pouring the last drizzle of beer out onto the earth.
"And names are strange things, dangerous things."
He gave them a pointed look.
"That I know for true because I am an educated man. If I'm a mite superstitious too," he shrugged. "Well, that's my choice. I'm old. You have to humor me."
My father nodded thoughtfully.
"It's odd, I never noticed that everyone treats the Chandrian the same. It's something I should have seen."
He shook his head as if to clear it.
"We can come back to names later, I suppose. What was it you wanted to talk about?"
I prepared to sneak off before I was caught. But what Ben said next froze me in place before I took a single step.
"It's probably hard to see, being his parents and all, but your young Kvothe is rather bright."
Ben refilled his cup and held out the jug to my father, who declined it.
"As a matter of fact, bright doesn't begin to cover it, not by half."
My mother watched Ben over the top of her mug.
"Anyone who spends a little time with the boy can see that, Ben. I don't see why anyone would make a point of it, least of all you."
"I don't think you really grasp the situation," Ben said.
stretching his feet almost into the fire.
How easily did he pick up the loot?
My father seemed a little surprised by the sudden change of topic.
Fairly easily, why?
How old was he?
My father tugged thoughtfully at his beard for a moment. In the silence, my mother's voice was like a flute.
8. Think back to when you learned to play. Can you remember how old you were? Can you remember the sort of difficulties you had?
My father continued to tug on his beard, but his face was more reflective now, his eyes far away. Abenthi continued.
I'll bet he learned each chord, each fingering after being shown just once. No stumbling, no complaining. And when he did make a mistake, it was never more than once, right?
My father seemed a little perturbed.
Mostly. But he did have trouble, just the same as anyone else. E chord. He had a lot of trouble with greater and diminished E.
My mother broke in softly. I remember too, dear, but I think it was just his small hands. He was awfully young.
I bet it didn't stall him for long,
Ben said quietly.
He does have marvelous hands. My mother would have called them magician's fingers.
My father smiled.
He gets them from his mother, delicate but strong, perfect for scrubbing pots, eh, woman?
My mother swatted him, then caught one of his hands in her own and unfolded it for Ben to see.
He gets them from his father, graceful and gentle, perfect for seducing young nobles' daughters.
My father started to protest, but she ignored him.
With his eyes and those hands, there won't be a woman safe in all the world when he starts hunting after the ladies.
Courting, dear, my father corrected gently.
Semantics,
she shrugged.
It's all a chase, and when the race is done, I think I pity women chased who run.
She leaned back against my father, keeping his hand in her lap. She tilted her head slightly, and he took his cue, leaning in to kiss the corner of her mouth.
Amen,
Ben said, raising his mug in salute. My father put his other arm around her and gave her a squeeze. I still don't see what you're getting at, Ben.
He does everything that way. Quick as a whip, hardly ever makes mistakes. I'll bet he knows every song you've ever sung to him. He knows more about what's in my wagon than I do.
He picked up the jug and uncorked it.
It's not just memorization, though. He understands. Half the things I've been meaning to show him he's already figured out for himself.
Ben refilled my mother's cup.
He's 11. Have you ever known a boy his age who talks the way he does? A great deal of it comes from living in such an enlightened atmosphere.
Ben gestured to the wagons.
But most 11-year-olds' deepest thoughts have to do with skipping stones and how to swing a cat by the tail.
My mother laughed like bells, but Abenthi's face was serious.
It's true, lady. I've had older students that would have loved to do half as well.
He grinned.
If I had his hands and 1/4 his wit, I'd be eating off silver plates inside a year.
There was a lull. My mother spoke softly.
I remember when he was just a little baby toddling around, watching, always watching, with clear, bright eyes that looked like they wanted to swallow up the world.
Her voice had a little quaver in it. My father put his arm around her, and she rested her head on his chest. The next silence was longer. I was considering sneaking away when my father broke it.
What is it you suggest we do?
His voice was a mix of mild concern and fatherly pride. Ben smiled gently.
Nothing, except to think about what options you might give him when the time comes. He will leave his mark on the world as one of the best.
The best what?
My father rumbled.
Whatever he chooses. If he stays here, I don't doubt he will become the next Ilion.
My father smiled. Ilion is the trooper's hero, the only truly famous Edema Rue in all of history. All our oldest, best songs are his songs. What's more, if you believe the stories, Ilion reinvented the lute in his lifetime. A master luthier, Ilion transformed the archaic, fragile, unwieldy court lute into the marvellous, versatile seven-string trooper's lute we use today. The same stories claim Ilion's own lute had 8 strings in all.
Ilion, I like that thought, my mother said. Kings coming from miles away to hear my little Kvothe play.
His music stopping barroom brawls and border wars,
Ben smiled.
The wild women in his lap, my father enthused, laying their breasts on his head.
There was a moment of stunned silence. Then my mother spoke slowly, with an edge to her voice.
I think you mean wild beasts laying their heads in his lap.
Do I? Ben coughed and continued.
If he decides to become an arcanist, I bet he'll have a royal appointment by the time he's 24. If he gets it into his head to be a merchant, I don't doubt he'll own half the world by the time he dies.
My father's brows knitted together. Ben smiled and said,
Don't worry about the last one. He's too curious for a merchant.
Ben paused, as if considering his next words very carefully.
He'd be accepted into the university, you know. Not for years, of course. 17 is about as young as they go, but I have no doubts about...
I missed the rest of what Ben said.
The university?
I'd come to think of it in the same way most children think of the Fae Court, a mythical place reserved for dreaming about. A school the size of a small town, 10 times 10,000 books. People who would know the answers to any question I could ever ask. It was quiet when I turned my attention back to them. My father was looking down at my mother, nestled under his arm.
How about it, woman? Did you happen to bed down with some wandering god 12 years ago? That might solve our little mystery.
She swatted at him playfully, and a thoughtful look crossed her face.
Come to think of it. There was a night, about 12 years ago, a man came to me. He bound me with kisses and cords of corded song. He robbed me of my virtue and stole me away.
She paused.
But he didn't have red hair, couldn't be him.
She smiled wickedly at my father, who appeared a little embarrassed. Then she kissed him. He kissed her back. That's how I like to remember them today. I snuck away with thoughts of the university dancing in my head.
Chapter 13. Interlude. Flesh with blood beneath. In the Waystone Inn, there was a silence. It surrounded the two men sitting at a table in an otherwise empty room. Kvothe had stopped speaking, and while he seemed to be staring down at his folded hands, in reality his eyes were far away. When he finally pulled his gaze upwards, he seemed almost surprised to find Chronicler sitting across the table, pen poised above his inkwell. Kvothe let out his breath self-consciously and motioned Chronicler to set down his pen. After a moment, Chronicler complied, wiping the nib of the pen on a clean cloth before setting it down.
I could use a drink, Kvothe announced suddenly as if he were surprised. I haven't told many stories lately and I find myself unreasonably dry.
He rose smoothly from the table and began to make his way through the maze of empty tables toward the empty bar.
I can offer you almost anything, dark ale, pale wine, spiced cider, chocolate, coffee.
Chronicler raised an eyebrow.
Chocolate would be wonderful if you have it. I wouldn't expect to find that sort of thing this far from...
He cleared his throat politely.
Well, anywhere. We have everything here at the Waystone, Kvothe said, making an offhand gesture to the empty room. Excepting any customers, of course.
He brought an earthenware jug up from underneath the bar, then set it on the bar with a hollow sound. He sighed before calling out,
Bast, bring up some cider, would you?
An indistinct reply echoed from a doorway at the back of the room.
Bast,
Quoth chided, seemingly too quiet to be heard.
Shag down here and get it yourself, you hack!
The voice shouted up from the basement.
I'm in the middle of something!
Hired help?
Chronicler asked. Quoth leaned his elbows on the bar and smiled indulgently. After a moment, the sound of someone climbing a set of wooden stairs in hard-soled boots echoed from the doorway. Bast stepped into the room, muttering under his breath. He was dressed simply, black long-sleeved shirt tucked into black pants tucked into soft black boots. His face was sharp and delicate, almost beautiful, with striking blue eyes. He carried a jug to the bar, walking with a strange and not unpleasant grace.
One customer, he said reproachfully. You couldn't get it yourself. You pulled me away from Calum Tincher. You've been harping on me to read it for nearly a month now.
Bast, do you know what they do to students at the university who eavesdrop on their teachers?
Quoth asked archly. Bast put a hand on his chest and began to protest his innocence.
Bast!
Quoth gave him a stern look. Bast closed his mouth and for a moment looked as if he was about to try and offer some explanation. Then his shoulders slumped.
How did you know?
Quoth chuckled.
You've been avoiding that book for a mortal age. Either you had suddenly become an exceptionally dedicated student or you were doing something incriminating.
What do they do to students at the university who eavesdrop?
Bast asked curiously.
I haven't the slightest idea. I was never caught. I think making you sit and listen to the rest of my story should be punishment enough. But I forget myself, Quoth said, gesturing to the common room. We are neglecting our guest.
Chronicler seemed anything but bored. As soon as Bast entered the room, Chronicler began to watch him curiously. As the conversation continued, Chronicler's expression had grown by degrees more puzzled and more intent. In fairness, something ought to be said about Bast. At first glance, he looked to be an average, if attractive, young man, but there was something different about him. For instance, he wore soft black leather boots. At least if you looked at him, that's what you saw, but if you happened to catch a glimpse of him from the corner of your eye, and if he was standing in the right type of shadow, you might see something else entirely. And if you had the right sort of mind, the sort of mind that actually sees what it looks at, you might notice that his eyes were odd. If your mind had the rare talent of not being fooled by its own expectations, you might notice something else about them, something strange and wonderful. Because of this, Chronicler had been staring at Quoth's young student, trying to decide what was different about him. By the time their conversation was through, Chronicler's gaze would be considered intense at the very least and rude by most. When Bast finally turned from the bar, Chronicler's eyes widened perceptibly, and the color drained from his already pale face. Chronicler reached inside his shirt and tugged something from around his neck. He set it on the table at arm's length between himself and Bast. All this was done in half a second, and his eyes never left the dark-haired young man at the bar. Chronicler's face was calm as he pressed the metal disc firmly onto the table with two fingers.
Iron, he said, his voice sounding with strange resonance as if it were an order to be obeyed. Bast doubled over as if punched in the stomach, baring his teeth and making a noise halfway between a growl and a scream. Moving with an unnatural, sinuous speed, he drew one hand back to the side of his head and tensed himself to spring. It all happened in the time it takes to draw a sharp breath. Still, somehow, Quoth's long-fingered hand caught Bast's wrist. Unaware or uncaring, Bast leapt toward Chronicler, only to be brought up short, as if Quoth's hand were a shackle. Bast struggled furiously to free himself, but Quoth stood behind the bar, arm outstretched, motionless as steel or stone.
Stop!
Quoth's voice struck the air like a commandment, and in the stillness that followed, his words were sharp and angry.
I will have no fighting among my friends. I have lost enough without that.
His eyes caught Chronicler.
Undo that, or I will break it.
Chronicler paused, shaken. Then his mouth moved silently, and with a slight tremor, he drew his hand away from the circle of dull metal that lay upon the table. Tension poured out of Bast, and for a moment he hung limply as a rag doll from the wrist Kvothe still held, standing behind the bar. Shakily, Bast managed to find his feet and lean against the bar. Kvothe gave him a long, searching look, then released his wrist. Bast slumped onto the stool without taking his eyes from Chronicler. He moved gingerly, like a man with a tender wound. And he had changed. The eyes that watched Chronicler were still a striking ocean blue, but now they showed themselves to be all one color, like gems or deep forest pools, and his soft leather boots had been replaced with graceful cloven hooves. Kvothe motioned Chronicler forward imperiously, then turned to grab two thick glasses and a bottle seemingly at random. He set the glasses down as Bast and Chronicler eyed each other uneasily.
Now, Kvothe said angrily. You've both acted understandably, but that does not by any means mean that either of you has behaved well, so we might as well start over altogether.
He drew a deep breath.
Bast, let me introduce you to Devon Lockies, also known as Chronicler. By all accounts, a great teller, rememberer, and recorder of stories. In addition, unless I have suddenly lost all my wit, an accomplished member of the Arcanum, at least Rela and one of perhaps 20 people in the world who knows the name of Iron. However, Kvothe continued, in spite of these accolades, he seems to be a bit innocent of the ways of the world, as demonstrated by his plentiful lack of wit in making a near-suicidal attack on what I guess is the first of the folk he has ever had the luck to see.
Chronicler stood impassively throughout the introduction, watching Bast as if he were a snake.
Chronicler, I would like you to meet Bastus, son of Raymond, Prince of Twilight and the Telwith Mail. The brightest, which is to say the only student I've had the misfortune to teach. Glamourer, bartender, and not last, my friend. Who, over the course of 150 years of life, not to mention nearly 2 years of my personal tutelage, has managed to avoid learning a few important facts, the first being this, attacking a member of the Arcanum skilled enough to make a binding of iron is foolish.
He attacked me,
said Bast hotly.
Kvothe looked at him coolly.
I didn't say it was unjustified. I said it was foolish.
I would have won.
Very likely, but you would have been hurt, and he would be hurt or dead. Do you remember that I had introduced him as my guest?
Bast was silent. His expression remained belligerent.
Now, said Kvothe with a brittle cheerfulness. You've been introduced.
Pleased,
Bast said icily.
Likewise, Chronicler returned.
There is no reason for you two to be anything other than friends,
Kvothe continued, an edge creeping into his voice.
And that is not how friends greet each other.
Bast and Chronicler stared at each other. Neither moved. Kvothe's voice grew quiet.
If you do not stop this foolishness, you may both leave now. One of you will be left with a slim sliver of story, and the other can search out a new teacher. If there is one thing I will not abide, it is the folly of a willful pride.
Something about the low intensity of Kvothe's voice broke the stare between them. And when they turned to look at him, it seemed that someone very different was standing behind the bar. The jovial innkeeper was gone, and in his place stood someone dark and fierce.
He's so young, Chronicler marveled.
He can't be more than 25. Why didn't I see it before? He could break me in his hands like a kindling stick. How did I ever mistake him for an innocent?